Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Nina Easton, who is the Deputy Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe in Washington, D.C., and she's the co-author of John F. Kerry, A Complete Biography. And of course, this is John Kerry's moment, and Nina's written the book on him, so we'll be getting a sense of who this man is and how he's reached this point in his journey to become president, if indeed he succeeds. We'll also speak with Michael Scott Duran, who's a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. He's a specialist on Saudi Arabia. And I spoke on Friday with Carmen bin Laden, who is the former sister-in-law of Osama bin Laden. And we'll play some clips of that interview and have a Saudi specialist comment on it, since Carmen tells us a human story of how she married a brother of bin Laden, who was something of a playboy living out here in California, and then went back to Saudi Arabia and entered a different world and basically managed to escape with her daughter so that her daughter wouldn't grow up in that world. So we'll be talking about that world and its effect on our world, given the amount of oil that's under the ground in Saudi Arabia and the growing radicalism of the street. And following on from that, we'll talk with Fadal Gait, who on the record oil prices, whether they will be a permanent fixture from now on, that $40 a barrel is not the ceiling but the floor for the future. Fadal Gait's a senior vice president for oil and gas research with Oppenheimer Incorporated in New York City. And he's spent 30 years in oil and gas research, previously with Mobil Oil and the J.P. Morgan Company in New York. So we'll be talking about the oil business. I'm speaking with Nina Easton, who's the deputy chief of the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau and a co-author of John F. Kerry, The Complete Biography. And clearly this is Kerry's moment, and you've written the book on Kerry. And Nina, just to go back a little bit, though, he started out as the anointed Democratic candidate, at least amongst the punditry, and it seemed as if he was the most presidential, the most qualified. But then it took him a long time to get any traction, and he's still, in spite of the problems that President Bush has with Iraq and with the economy and with his contentious and controversial vice president, he's still polling at 50%. So let's go back in the journey. What happened in the beginning, and why did it take him so long to get some traction amongst the Democratic voters?
Well, it's interesting, and this book grew out of a 7-part series that we did last June, and meaning a year ago last June. And at the time, we were talking about turning it into a book, and then, of course, his campaign tanked, and nobody thought he was going to be the Democratic nominee. Then along comes, November, December, and he's suddenly back on track, and he's the nominee just within a couple months. Or the presumed nominee, I should say, at that point. It's interesting because I think two things happened in that process. One is that that there's such an anti-Bush sentiment in this country. I keep saying that there's a lot of passion in this race. It's all around George Bush, pro or con, less so around Kerry. So I think that coalesced in last winter during the primary season, where they saw Democratic voters really saw John Kerry as somebody who could stand up and potentially beat George Bush. They weren't sure Howard Dean could do that. Secondly, and this is what we saw at the convention last week, John Kerry traditionally in his political history reaches back to this period in Vietnam, to this combat in Vietnam when he was became a war hero, a decorated war hero, and he draws on that to portray himself as a strong and capable leader. He did it in 1984 in a close primary race where his former crewmates from Vietnam emerged and kind of surrounded him and kind of embellished his credentials. He did it again in 1996 in a race against a very popular Republican governor, Bill Weld. he, again, the crewmates emerged, the so-called Band of Brothers. We saw them again last week. We saw them on stage at the Democratic Convention. We saw John Kerry's supporters very much standing on stage and saying, using words like strength and commander-in-chief. I have to say, it didn't really feel like a Democratic convention. At the times, it felt more like a Republican convention. And but he definitely, they definitely feel that that's the softness for Kerry in the polls right now. That if he's going to win this election, he needs to draw from the center. And in order to do that, he needs to make those centrist voters feel like they're safe and secure at a time when we're under a threat of a terrorist attack, when we've got the war in Iraq, and so on. The other interesting thing was last week at the convention, the Boston Globe, my paper, we polled the delegates, and 95% opposed the war in Iraq, which, of course, John Kerry voted for. He's been critical of the way it's been executed. Nevertheless, he voted for it. So I keep wondering, you know, sort of under a President Kerry, are we going to see, what's he going to do when he's faced with this anti-war sentiment? It's going to be, because there is this disjunction. The party's extremely united against George Bush right now, but they've been able to paper over these differences.
Well, if he gets elected, he's going to inherit a mess.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to inherit Vietnam, which he protested against.
Right. But how does he navigate this problem that you alluded to, Nina Easton? That is, that as he reaches out to the center and to moderate Republicans, he alienates the left.
I think this is why we see some of these allegations of flip-flopping from the Republicans, but in fact, you know, stick. You know, they resonate with people. For example, just a couple weeks ago, Kerry, who has been one of the most adamant abortion rights supporters in the Senate, to the extent where last year, in the middle of a presidential campaign, one of the few votes he cast, he flew back to Washington to cast the vote against partial birth abortion ban. Now,
which the Republicans are using in their commercials.
Right. And now he's saying, well, I believe life begins at conception, and I'm personally opposed to abortion. Now, that's not exactly a flip-flop. Those two views could coincide. Nevertheless, he's borrowing the language of the pro-life movement to explain his, you know, pro-choice position. And I think that gets confusing to people, and it feeds it kind of feeds that sensibility about him that he isn't declarative and isn't doesn't have a clear vision. On the other hand, George Bush has his problems too, which we're not here to talk about because we wrote a book about John Kerry. So that you're weighing these two candidates, but I do think he will. The next big event where the campaigns have some control over. They don't have a lot of control over what happens in Iraq. We don't have a lot of control over, the threat of a terrorist attack. But they do have control over certain moments in the campaign, one of which is the debates. There will be three debates coming up this fall. John Kerry is a very, very good debater. He was known as a great debater at prep school, again at Yale. He started his career, interestingly enough, as a prosecutor. And so he really knows how to take an argument and use it. He's got this very restless, probing intellect. And I think he will probably do quite well in that venue.
But in terms of, he tried to, through his daughters and through surrogates, try to present, and of course that's the purpose of these conventions, to introduce the candidate to the electorate. In terms of who he is as a person, on the surface, he seems like a decent guy. I've always thought he was a decent guy. He's got a decent record. The Republicans are saying it's a thin, undistinguished Senate record. But just deal with him as a man, you know him. You spent some number of years covering him. How do you think he I mean, I know it's a broad question, but how do you think he measures up? Because a lot of people do have problems with George Bush because he's an incendiary character. You either love him or loathe him.
Right.
Let me ask you this then. Why is it apparently difficult to court the American people? He seems on the surface like a decent guy, yet he somehow hasn't introduced himself fully.
Well, he does. He has this mannerism that is quite reserved, and of course people use that term aloof. And in doing the book, I came up with my own theory about this, which is that people think of him as being from Massachusetts. He's really not from a community in Massachusetts. He was born in Denver. He lived in Massachusetts for a few years in his youth, but his father was a Foreign Service officer. They moved to Washington and then overseas, and then at age 11, he was shipped off to boarding school. And as he says in the book, you know, we were always moving on. We were always saying goodbye. It steeled you. And it was very difficult, I think. He was constantly being put into new situations. He was also not even part, he was sort of part of this very elite, wealthy world, but his family didn't have money. His mother had some money, but his father was a Foreign Service officer. He lived on a government salary. So he was going to these very elite prep schools, particularly St. Paul's, where he was, first of all, the only Democrat. Everybody else was Republican around. He was also, a great aunt was the one who was able to send him there. She was the one who picked up the tab. So he was always kind of on the outskirts of that world, too. So I think that accounts for some of this. We also, just going back in his family history, I mean, he really does have the most rich, fascinating family history. But his, except for a quirk of history, we'd be talking about John Cone, not John Kerry, because in fact his grandparents were both Jewish. They were from the Austrian Empire. They faced a lot of anti-Semitism, changed their name and their religion to Catholicism, and emigrated to the United States. And then his grandfather, who was a quite successful merchant, but made and lost a couple of fortunes, and in losing the third one, got depressed, walked into the Copley Plaza Hotel, which is a place that he would have frequented, and given his station in life. In the middle of a lunch hour, he pulled out a gun and shot himself in the washroom. And this, I think, accounts for, you know, this kind of accounts somewhat, I think, for the distance of John Kerry's own father. He's talked about his father being a loving man, but distant. And so all of these things in his youth, I think, kind of combined to create a man who doesn't seem terribly at ease around groups of people. On the other hand, he's had close friends who have stuck by his side for decades, and you still see them in the campaign and with him. So he does have a core group of friends, but he's always had trouble, I think, connecting in that Bill Clinton way with people. I mean, Bill Clinton just lit the crowd on fire when he appeared there last Monday night at the convention. And you just, you know, Kerry's speech was good, solid, but he doesn't light crowds on fire the way Bill Clinton did.
And it was interesting, Nina Easton, in the biographical stuff where it went, where he was talking about the joy of seeing his daughters born, and then it cut from that to his wife, his new wife.
Right. Somebody was joking, immaculate conception.
Right. There was a
first wife, right.
Not a lot of mention of her, but on the other hand, his former brother-in-law is still one of his closest confidants. So,
yes, his former brother, his best friend is David Thorne. David Thorne is the twin brother of Julia Thorne, his first wife.
And the mother of the two girls.
And the mother of the two girls. And Julia described herself as, she grew up in Europe, as did, you know, Kerry spent much of his youth in Europe. She grew up in Italy. She describes herself as a jet setter, not now so much, but, you know, in her youth, she was expected to, you know, just, she didn't go to college. She was expected to just marry very well, and that would be it. Instead, she married John Kerry. She talks about how he became like a tutor in her life. She loved listening to his talking about public policy and so on. But Julia suffered from depression, and in 1980 she sat at the edge of a bed, ready to take her life. She had two young daughters and this husband, John Kerry, who was a lawyer at the time. She was about to take her life, and she was interrupted by a phone call. And she got some help eventually. Again, in 1985, had another bout of kind of suicidal tendencies. Eventually got serious help, turned her life around. They were divorced during that period, separated and then divorced during that period. And she has since moved on, and she's in Montana now and has remarried. And she's written about this. She's written about not so much their marriage, but the depression that she went through. She's written a self-help book for other people who go through this. But, you know, these were that was a very difficult, I think, first marriage, difficult time for John Kerry in the 80s when he was a senator. He was broke for large periods of time because she was the one who had the money, had any family money at all. He had a home in Boston. He was trying to maintain a home in Boston and an apartment in Washington, and having trouble doing that and kind of shuttling back and forth to take care of his two daughters. So it was a difficult time. Therese actually refers to it as his gypsy years, because he would sleep on the couches of friends and lobbyists for long stretches at a time. So, you know, that's another piece to his personal history that I think kind of explains a little bit more about John Kerry the man.
Well, but I think he's the relationship with Therese has obviously turned things around for him, hasn't it? I mean, they seem genuinely in love, and even though sometimes you see her on the stage, she seems to suck the oxygen out of the background.
Right.
They clearly have got a real strong relationship.
Yeah, and they are very much bonded over policy, too, by the way. She's a very staunch environmentalist and has used the Heinz Family Foundation in that direction, and he's, of course, been interested in environmental issues for many years, so that's something that has bound them together. Theresa Heinz is interesting. Like, I thought she was fantastic at the convention, but I know a lot of people didn't, and I think there's an eccentricity about her that you either like or you don't like. A friend of mine described her as pistachio ice cream and Laura Bush as vanilla ice cream. I mean, you know, Laura Bush will go over with large parts of America. Theresa may not. I thought she performed quite well, though, at the convention. She talked about herself, which she got criticized for, but I thought it was important for her to talk about herself because people don't know her, where she's from. She grew up in Mozambique when it was a Portuguese colony. Her father was a doctor. They had to basically escape from a Marxist dictatorship at the time, which had took over a lot of the family savings. So she had this interesting childhood in Africa. She marched against apartheid in South Africa when she was going to school there. She studied and learned five languages, and at the convention she did a little line in each of the five languages. So she's got this really interesting background and this great love of America, frankly, because of what she went through. And then she married Senator John Heinz, a Republican from Pennsylvania, who, of course, died in an air crash in the early 90s. And she was a widow by the time that she and John Kerry started dating.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may. I'm speaking with Nina Easton, who's the deputy chief of the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau and one of the authors of John F. Kerry, A Complete Biography. And just to, in the last minutes, Nina, to return to the kind of questions that I have. I mean, given that a lot of people and pundits thought from the beginning that Kerry would be the most likely candidate, and then he went through that wilderness, and then he reached a kind of critical mass in Iowa, where people, the electorate, made that decision that he was the most electable, not necessarily the most popular, but the most electable. And it seems that we've reached a point now that he is the candidate that the country, I think a lot of the country has made the decision about Bush, and quite a few, I think, have decided not to vote for him. But they haven't made the second decision to vote for Kerry. And, of course, we were mentioning earlier how he's reaching out to the center and to the moderate Republicans who aren't happy by the domination of the Christian right in their party, et cetera. So how does he get them to make that second decision, given that it's apparently a little easier to make the decision not to vote for Bush? But in fact, he mentioned it the other day, addressing Republicans, how do you, trying to encourage them to make that decision, the second leap?
Well, I think he's got to continue doing what he started at the convention, which is show himself as a safe, secure, responsible leader, you know, during these dangerous times. I think, you know, at the end of the day, people, and I've heard this from pollsters, that people are reluctant to, even if they have problems with Bush, they're reluctant to, you know, break off and say that they're going to vote for Kerry because he is the incumbent president. And, you know, there is a sense during dangerous times that you want to be you know, change isn't necessarily a good thing. So you don't really, you didn't hear a lot of talk about change, that word change that Bill Clinton used in 1992, you know, change, youth, that vigor. What you saw in the convention was more of a trying to look, you know, convey a sense of gravitas and of commander-in-chief, of, you know, firm hand. Even the daughters talked about the sureness of his hand and the wisdom of his heart. I mean, there is a, you will hear a lot of that in the next few months, and as well as, I think, trying to, people, the other thing that pollsters show, by the way, is there's more interest in this election than there has been in elections for a very long time. And I think people are starting to pay attention. The crowds were huge yesterday, both for Kerry and for Bush. People are really paying attention, and I think he just got to just keep delivering that message. You know, I'm not, my job isn't to write victory prescriptions for him. It's to cover him as a journalist. But
no,
I think it's you know, I can see what they're, I can see the logic of what the campaign is doing.
Right. No, that's what I was questioning, was the the strategy is pretty clear. It's just whether or not he can really make that second argument for those wavering people, because and at the same time keep the disaffected left in the tent.
Right. So right. Well, I think the disaffected left will stay in the tent through the election. I think it's a question of if he's elected after that. I do think that that's going to be an issue.
Right. Well, just in closing, though, give me your personal feelings about him as a man, given that that's what he was trying to. He was both trying to show the strong hand, and of course,
right.
He came on and saluted and said, "Commander, and you know, reporting for duty." Clearly, there's subtext to that.
Right. Well, I think there's. I think the. I'll give you sort of what I see as both the upsides and the downsides to him as a leader. I think he's definitely an internationalist. He understands the world. He's been had a front and center seat. You know, on the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, he's done important investigations in the Senate, both into the Iran-Contra affair, later into the question of whether MIAs were being held in Indochina. Very riveting, difficult question at the time. He does have this. Certainly, he knows how to look at all sides of an issue. He's got a very probing intellect that looks at all sides of an issue. I think the question in people's minds still is this, you know, I joke that George Bush's problem is he's too black and white. Well, then John Kerry's problem is that he's plaid. I mean, I do think that there is a concern that his decision-making style isn't declarative enough, clear enough, you know, doesn't know, what seems too eager to please whatever audience he's with. And I think that's something that he has to address and has to look courageous and take courageous stands. And that's, I think, what people are going to be looking for. The Republicans have, you know, thrown out this flip-flop thing, but it wouldn't stick unless there was something there. And I think that the problem is that there is something there, and that Kerry really does need to overcome that and look like a decisive leader. People want they want a decisive, whatever your politics are, people want a decisive leader right now. And I think he's really got to portray that.
So, in other words, it's a race between a thinker and a believer.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
I thank you for joining us, Nina.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Nina Easton, who's the Deputy Chief of the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau and the author of John F. Kerry, The Complete Biography. I'm now speaking with Michael Scott Durand, who's a professor of Near East Studies at Princeton University. And Michael, I spoke with Carmen Bin Laden on Friday. She's the author of Inside the Kingdom, a memoir of her experience married to Bin Laden's brother, Yeslam, and she managed to get out of the country. Should we just play a clip of that and have you comment? Or is any... at least say hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, good. Let me just begin then with a clip of, because you know you're a specialist on Saudi Arabia. You've been there, and I was hoping we could get her sort of more human response to what her life was about, what she experienced, and then segue into some kind of political analysis. Let's go to a clip of Carmen Bin Laden. I'm speaking with Carmen Bin Laden, the author of Inside the Kingdom, My Life in Saudi Arabia. And Carmen, is it Is it an act of God having a sense of humor or a sense of irony that so much of the world's energy supply is under the sand of this small desert kingdom that seems to be completely dysfunctional as a tribe, as a family, as a country? The more you learn about life inside Saudi Arabia, the more you think, what an irony it is that there's so much power and money.
Excuse me, Ian?
Yes?
Hi. Ms. Bin Laden does not want to talk about her religious background.
I'm not talking about a religious background.
I don't know what happened.
We have somebody on the line censoring this interview. Hello? Are you there?
Hello?
Let me begin again, Carmen.
Yes. Sorry.
You say in your book, Carmen, Inside the Kingdom, that you saw this moment of liberalization and then the retreat into more of the Wahhabi strict code of behavior. So,
well, when I say I saw the liberation, it was not actually a liberation as we see it in Western world. The small changes that were giving me hope, because I wanted to believe really that things will change, then any small changes, like the fact that I was being able to go to the supermarket with my driver, all I took them as a hope for the future. But those were small changes. I realized that the basic rights of a woman were not going to change.
But do you know what happened inside the kingdom? I mean, why is it that the Wahhabi and the Mutawa, the religious police, why did they get more and more power? They seem to be more and more in control of that
because
country.
You have to understand, the base of the Saudi society is the Wahhabist Islamists, which is very, very strong. And you have to understand that this form of Islam, it's very, very strong in that society. And the society basis and the culture of that society is based on the Sharia law.
In terms of your family, your ex-husband, Yaslam, was a brother of Osama bin Laden. Did you get the impression that Osama bin Laden was indeed pious and religious, or was
he? Of course, you know, Osama was among the family and well-respected and much loved and admired because of his strong devotion to Islam.
So when people in the West and here in the United States describe bin Laden as a criminal and a heretic, how does that compare to the person you know? You're saying he's a religious man, but
no, you know, I see it as a Westerner because I am a Westerner. But my perception of Osama is the same as anybody else in the Western world. But I know, for me, in Saudi Arabia, Osama is well-liked and admired.
Marcus Scott-Duran, any reaction there to Carmen bin Laden?
Well, I think she's right when she says that the society itself is very, very conservative, and we can expect small changes on the issue of women, but we shouldn't hold our breath to see any kind of great wave of liberalism sweeping Saudi Arabia. That goes not just for the women's issue, but I think a number of important social issues that touch on the question of who's part of the community, who's inside the community, and who's outside the community, the political community. So, for instance, with regard to Shiites as well, 10% of the population of Saudi Arabia is Shiite. They're concentrated in the eastern province.
Where the oil is.
Where the oil is, right. And they would like to have greater rights, greater political rights. And I'm not holding my breath for that. It's very difficult for the government to do that because it brings the government up against the clerical establishment, which doesn't want to let go of power, and it wants to maintain these strict lines between the in group and the out group.
But that's what the royal family have always navigated between their private prerogatives and the outward piety of the Wahhabis, and there have been ebbs and flows of Wahhabi power. I think Abdulaziz put a lot to the sword at one point, when they got too powerful. So, can you give me a sense of this historical ebb and flow of this relationship, where in effect the House of Saud play us against them?
Sure. In the late 20s and early 30s, there was what was called the Ikhwan movement, which were radical Wahhabis who basically wanted to take this notion. At the heart of the Wahhabi worldview is the notion that there's a struggle going on between truth and falsehood, and that the people who are, you know, the followers of truth, which means, you know, the dogmas of Wahhabism, have to go and struggle, carry out jihad against the people who represent falsehood. So the state used Wahhabism as a state building mechanism. It sort of took these tribesmen, infused them with this religious zeal, and then beamed them out toward the groups that the state wanted to conquer. It was a great way of kind of, if you have a lot of different tribes that have different identities as tribes and different interests and are kind of fighting with each other, Wahhabism is a great way of saying, look, actually we all are unified around this single idea, and the bad guys are over there. And so you take all the tribes and you unify them, and then you take their martial power and you beam it out. What happened in the late 20s and 30s is that the tribesmen said to the state as well, you're not being, you know, you're not following the idea to its logical conclusion. You're not going and fighting the British and the Shiites up there in Iraq. We have to go do that. And so the state-building impulse behind Wahhabism and the sort of just ideological zeal ran up against each other, and the state won, and the state smashed the radicals. What we're living through right now is a replay of that, but without the tribal component. I mean, Saudi society in the last 70, 80 years has changed considerably, and so we don't have a lot of tribesmen running around, but we still have this idea, this notion of the good versus the evil. And in the 19, we started to see a conflict arising in the 80s and especially in the 90s. This statist component, the kind of status quo component of Wahhabism that won out in the 20s and 30s, started being challenged by new social religious movements, which pointed to behavior of the Saudi elite and said, you know, they're not really true Muslims, because they're aligned with the West, with the Americans. They do the bidding of the Americans. They do the bidding of the Israelis, and so forth. And they're living in, you know, a non-Muslim, that is, Western lifestyle as well. So there was a critique, a social conservatism combined with a critique of the foreign relations of the Saudi state. And that really came to a head in 1990 when Saddam went into Kuwait and the Saudis lined up with the Americans against Saddam. From the point of view of a Wahhabi, taking the side of a kafir, of a non-Muslim against a Muslim, however imperfect that Muslim may be, right? I mean, even, you know, taking the side of a kafir against a Muslim criminal makes you a kafir as well, makes you an infidel as well.
And that's where Bin Laden started to emerge and got
traction. That's when
Bin Laden started
to emerge. And he came up together. Bin Laden emerged at the same time as another movement called the Sahwa, which is the Awakening Sheikhs. The Awakening Sheikhs, you might have heard of them lately, are the most famous names are Safar al-Hawali, Salman al-Auda, Ayad al-Karni. There's another guy who's associated with the Sahwa whose name is Muhsin al-Awaji, who knows English quite well, and he's quoted all the time. These guys were, and Bin Laden, were pretty much on the same page in the 90s. Then after September 11th, there developed a divergence, which is very important for understanding what's happening in Saudi Arabia today. The divergence was this: the Sahwa Sheikhs, who are socially conservative, concerned about, you know, not letting women have greater rights and not letting the Shia have rights and so forth, above all, making sure that the clerics have a dominant role in education and in police and so forth. They were against against carrying the jihad to the Americans in Washington. And in New York, the attacks on New York and Washington, September 11th. And in particular, they don't agree with Bin Laden when he calls for rebellion against the Saudi government. They probably, if they sat one-on-one in a room with the door shut with Bin Laden, they would probably agree with Bin Laden that the Saudi family is corrupt that the Saudi family is non-Muslim and so forth, but they would say that for the better, for the greater good of society, we can't afford to fight each other. And so we should not be carrying out jihad internally against the Saudi government.
Now, at this point, though, it's come to a head, hasn't it, Michael Scott Durand, with this amnesty offer, where the House of Saud, King Abdullah, has offered amnesty to al-Qaeda people to stop the insurgency. And I believe that what's being brokered there is you tell me, because it seems to me that what's being brokered there is that we'll forgive you, but the deal is the royals get is more stability, but what the religious people who are brokering the deal get is more religious conservatism.
Exactly. That's exactly what's going on. These same guys, Safar al-Hawali, Mohsen al-Awaji, that I mentioned before, they're the ones who first floated the proposal back in November and December, after the bombings in November, of an amnesty proposal. They have quietly, behind the scenes, been working for the Interior Ministry, that is Prince Nayef, trying to convince young men to lay down their arms. And then finally, about a month ago, the Crown Prince signed on to the amnesty idea as well. But it's these same guys from the Awakening Movement that I mentioned who are fronting for the government, trying to convince al-Qaeda to lay down its arms. And what they're saying to these to the young men who are flocking to al-Qaeda's banner is this isn't the way to get what we want. The struggle against the United States and the struggle against the falsehood takes place on many different dimensions and in many different arenas at once. There's an economic and a cultural and so forth. And if we carry out the jihad, we risk losing everything. And so we have to consolidate our base here. If I might add here, it's interesting. You were asking Carmen Bin Laden about the isn't it funny that this dysfunctional kingdom has all this oil? These guys have a view of all of that, which is quite fascinating. Both Al Qaeda and Dasahwa, they're on the same page in this regard. They say that the period that we're living through right now in human history is directly analogous to the or in Islamic history is directly analogous to the period of the Prophet Muhammad, who was surrounded by idolaters, and he harnessed all this Arabian tribal power and beamed the Arabs out to the surrounding civilizations to bring the light of Islam to them. They say that we're in a similar situation, that the Muslims have fallen away from true Islam, and it is the role of Saudi Arabia to bring back everybody to true Islam. And it's not by accident that all this oil is there in Saudi Arabia, because the true Islam is in Saudi Arabia, and the means to and the means to spread it around the world is there as well.
Let's take a quick clip of Carmen Bin Laden and have a last comment, Michael.
Sure.
But at this point, there's a $25 million bounty on Osama bin Laden's head, and there was some expectation he may be captured soon. And in fact, one of his lieutenants was captured last Sunday, and it was just announced on the last day of the Democratic Convention that they had a high-value target. So do you think that if they were to capture bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, it would make any difference to the spread of radical Islam?
I hope I am wrong, but I don't believe that. I think there are other people who will follow in Osama. Osama is not alone. This is what I believe.
So just in the final analysis then, Carmen bin Laden, you don't think that there... You think that the more radical form of Islam, the Wahhabism, is here to stay, it's growing, and you don't see anything on the horizon in terms of moderating it and rolling it back?
No, I think the more radicalism of Islam is for a lot of Saudis there to stay.
And that was an interview I just did on Friday with Carmen bin Laden, who is the former sister-in-law of Osama bin Laden. She's the author of Inside the Kingdom. A last comment, if I can, from Michael Scott Durand, who's a professor of Near East Studies at Princeton University. Michael, comment, if you will, but I just wanted to close with the, with this little reported story that there was a riot outside of Mecca, I think within the last month, involving the tribe from which the Prophet Muhammad comes. And this tribe were upset by a member of the royal family who'd basically stolen some land from them. So again, you know, we talked about the division between the House of Saud and the Wahhabis and how they navigate and play one and off against the other. But it seems that the one element that you didn't mention is sheer corruption and greed. And that's a country full of young men with nothing to do. And they used to be taken care of by the oil money, and they're not.
That's exactly it. I mean, there's underneath this this radical Islamic worldview, there are a lot of people with a lot of different motives, or you know, a lot of different circumstances lead them to see to see in the radical worldview a solution to their problems. And some of those problems can be economic, some can be concerned about corruption, some can be purely pure religious, some can be regional as well. I mean, you can feel like your region is, because the radical worldview, it says that the people who are ruling you, the Saudi family, are not authentic Muslims. They're not really one of us. They're actually part of that Western world over there. So it just allows you to feel that I'm the true Muslim, and those guys are the outsiders, and that you know, that kind of emotion can be fueled by a lot of different feelings. I'm not so sure that Karman bin Laden is right that the future belongs to these guys. And one of the reasons that I think their internal struggle got projected out onto the United States is that they really feel themselves to be losing ground. You know, the women's issue is one of those things. The appeal of the freedom that Western women have is very strong in the Islamic world.
Well, it's also how can, in the 21st century, how can any society survive where half of their population simply have no rights?
Well, this is one of the things that's working against these guys, is that it's not viable economically and politically. And they have this problem that you mentioned, this demographic problem of 50% of the population is under the age of 20. The economy is not keeping pace with the population's growth. And they have to provide jobs for these people. A high school student in Saudi Arabia spends 60% of his or her time studying religion. You can't produce a modern workforce like that. So the fundamental needs of the modern economy are working against these guys.
Well,
and
I thank you for joining us, Michael. I'm sorry we ran out of time, but again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Michael Scott Durand, a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, and we also had clips from an interview I did on Friday with Karman bin Laden, the former sister-in-law of Osama bin Laden and the author of Inside the Kingdom. I'm now speaking with Fadel Gait, who is he's a senior vice president for oil and gas research with Oppenheimer Incorporated in New York City. And previously, in the last 30 years, he's been in the oil and gas research business. And he's previously been with Mobil Oil and the J.P. Morgan Company. And am I correct, Fadel, the supposition that $40 a barrel oil is, in fact, the floor, not the ceiling, and that from now on this is going to be the way it is?
Well, I just hope not. No, I think that the $40 oil does not reflect really market factor supply and demand, but it really is a result of growing concern over potential supply disruption. And that's why you have a $43 oil, not $25 or $26 oil.
So you've got about a $15 premium there, which is a psychological tax?
Correct.
And how do you get rid of that?
Well, unfortunately, this is like the genie out of the bottle. It's very difficult to put it back in. this is like comedy of errors. We made so many mistakes, and this is the culmination of so many things that created this $43 oil. How long will the $43 oil last? I am not sure. But history has shown when oil prices spike in a very big way, usually market factors and forces will force a violent correction to the downside.
So, but what is contributing towards this disquiet on the part of traders that have them bidding it up because they think that at some point soon there will be an interruption in supply? I mean, I thought that the whole purpose of the Bush administration's war in Iraq, notwithstanding weapons of mass destruction and alleged connections to between Saddam and al-Qaeda, the reason was to stabilize oil supply, and some people think to dominate oil supply.
Well, the fact of the matter is that we depend on more than 50% of our oil on imports, a big piece of it coming from the Middle East. And at the end of the day, this is the region where most of the reserves are found. And in order for us to secure supply in the long run, we have to be there. And the only way we can be there, either to be invited by the governments there, or as we have done in Iraq, we go there uninvited.
But I understand that the oil industry, in the last 4 years of President Bush's incumbency, they have made more profit than in the past 20 years combined, and that if we're paying, if $15 of the $43 barrel for oil is psychological and not real in terms of supply and demand, then you have to admit that whether whatever the motives are, the bottom line is that this is creating a windfall. Because if it's 15% or 20, 30% more than it should be,
that's correct.
That's a lot of money that's pouring into the hands.
That's correct. But, you know, one thing will have to be fair here. I mean, the oil industry was not the cause of the $43 oil. It is failed American foreign policy that contributed to the rise in crude oil prices. So for the oil industry to generate windfall profit, obviously they are keeping their mouth shut but laughing all the way to the bank. They are not going to go out of their way to say, please don't pay me $43. After all, the $43 is given to them. They have really no influence on the $43 oil.
Well, what is the story, as much as you can figure out? And again, you're a senior vice president for oil and gas research with Oppenheimer Incorporated in New York, and I guess it's your job to figure these things out. When Shell recently revised its estimates on its reserves and revised them drastically downward, does this indicate that perhaps there is less oil than the Seven Sisters and the OPEC is saying? Because obviously it's in everybody's interest to exaggerate their reserves, because that's, in a sense, their collateral.
That's correct. I would think of Shell reclassification of proved reserve as more of a company-specific. Other companies such as ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, Texaco, and all the other large oil companies came out with a very strong statement that they have a very high level of confidence in their estimates. I remind most of the people that I talk to that when I was doing my graduate studies almost 30 years ago, the reserve life of the large oil companies at the time was about 10 to 11 years of production. 30 years later, they have a longer reserve life than they had before. And the reason for that, basically, is improvement in technology, reservoir management and engineering, cost efficiency, computerization. So all in all, I would regard the Shell problem as a company problem, not as an industry problem.
Well, in terms of if the $43 a barrel has there's a premium there because of psychological insecurity. And also there's a lot of instability in Iraq, and we just got through talking about in Saudi Arabia. We are, as a society, are addicted on for cheap oil. We pay nothing compared to what the rest of the world, and it seems to be almost an American birthright to have cheap gasoline.
That's correct.
And you can well speculate that if we are suddenly have a cold shower and have to join the real world and start paying $5 to $10 a gallon for gasoline, then that is going to be traumatic for this country. So, in terms of our political leadership, it doesn't seem like the Bush administration has an energy plan. The one that they developed was done in secret. What would you suggest in terms of somebody starting to educate the American people and prepare them for a calamity that may well be underway?
Well, it's unfortunate because, like, you have a kid and you just the upbringing process was not really the right way, and now the kid is 20 years old.
So you've got a spoiled brat who's 20 years old, right?
It's really very difficult to teach them discipline at this point. So it has to come gradually, but it has to be like tough love. The politician, and I do not want to focus on the current administration, because the Clinton White House and the Bush White House and even the Reagan White House, no one really leveled with the American people and told people the truth, that we are dependent on foreign oil and we are very wasteful and we really have to curtail our appetite. And the alternatives are the following. If we cannot stop that, we have to pay for it. And in order for us to get off this bad habit, the government has to have the conviction and the vision and the honesty to implement certain strategy and certain program. But since the Carter White House, no American president really addressed the energy dependency or the oil dependency. It was always put in the back burner, and you have the Anwar discussions and all the philosophical discussion and interest groups. So whether it's the environmentalists versus the Sierra Club versus the oil lobby and whatever, the bottom line is it really created an impasse. And every president since Jimmy Carter, hope that the next president will take care of it, or doesn't want to stick their neck out, if you will, to do something that is not popular. People are not going to be interested in paying $4 or $5 for gasoline that the Europeans are paying right now.
Which is about 70% tax?
In many cases, even higher than that.
Right.
And basically, because the governments in Europe, they face reality, and they said, okay, this is something you guys have to realize, is that this thing is not going to come cheaply, and therefore we are going to increase taxes. But I can cite, President Bush, but as I said, all the previous presidents, they had that chance, if you will, when oil prices were much lower, that could gradually increase taxes on oil, so the American people don't wake up one day and see that they are facing, $6 gas at the pump. But if we gradually pay 10 or 15 cents a gallon more every year for the last 10 or 15 years, would be paying now $3, $4, $5, but it would not have really caused the hardship that we might face now.
In other words, the purpose of adding the tax would be to invest in alternatives and conservation.
Number one is conservation.
Right.
I do believe that first of all, let's face reality. We will never be energy independent. We will never stop import. It's impossible because we import almost 60% of the oil that we use. So anyone that can say anything differently is very dishonest.
Let me just in the last few minutes then, Fadel Gaita, who is Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer Incorporated in New York, just to you know, we're talking about the fact that we've got $43 a barrel oil, a big chunk of that is psychological premium because of insecurity and hedging against an expected or possible interruption in the Middle East. This you have to combine, though, in looking at the global picture, these new customers that are coming on like gangbusters, China and India.
Correct.
And just recently, you know, we got this insecurity in Russia because the KGB essentially taking over that country. And and they obviously don't like the idea of these billionaires who put money into campaigns of politicians they don't like. So they're squeezing the head of UKOS, and you've got the situation now where a lot of, you know, the market's going up because people are, UKOS is all maybe off the market. Russia's the second biggest supplier. Putin, by the way, just recently reclassified Russian reserves, made it a state secret. So just in this broad picture, there is more demand for oil, clearly, globally.
There is no question in my mind that demand for oil will probably continue to rise. But also we have to remember here that global demand is approximately 80 to 82 million barrels per day. If collectively we can conserve in the tune of 2 to 3% of consumption, we could shave off 2 to 3 million barrels a day of consumption collectively, as I said, globally. So my thinking here is that concerted effort to conserve energy could more than offset the increase in demand, which is inevitable in China and India.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Fadel Gaita. Of course, the place where most of it's wasted, I believe, or the most wasteful country of all is Russia. Obviously, nothing much has been happening here in terms of conservation. The Vice President Cheney said it's a personal virtue, but it's irrelevant. So we certainly don't have leadership at that level. I thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was speaking there with Fadel Gaita, who's a Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer Incorporated in New York. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, and Mark Maxwell, the engineer, and I also thank Grant Gruber and Carol Coote, assistant producers. And this program, as all previous programs, can be accessed at ianmasters.org, ianmasters.org.